Hello and welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. Our vision is that no one is excluded from the joy, fulfillment and lifelong benefits of sport. If this is your first time listening to our podcast, you're very welcome. We all know sport can give girls resilience, courage and a sense of belonging. But from as early as five, gender stereotypes and cultural bias are instilling fear in girls and limiting their confidence, self-belief and well-being. And it doesn't seem to matter what walk of life they're from. We polled more than 4,000 teenagers, and 43% of girls who felt sporty at primary school said they no longer saw themselves that way at secondary. This equates to around 1.3 million girls across the UK. Teenage girls today are heading towards a crisis of inactivity, catastrophic for both their mental and physical health. My name is Julia George. Welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. In the next couple of episodes, we're focusing on the needs and experiences of Black British teenage girls. Our research shows that they have some of the most positive attitudes to and aspirations in sport. 60% of Black girls aged 13 to 24 dream of reaching the top in sport, compared to 33% of white British girls. And yet, Black girls are the least physically active group of girls. Our latest research, to be published in the spring of 2025, includes the testimony of Black girls, including, crucially, those who have fallen out of love with sport. We want to know why and what can be done to prevent this.
There's a quote that came out of the research that says, "I feel like us as Black women, our safe space is other Black women." So when you're surrounded with people that look like you, have the same shared experiences, you're more likely to enjoy something than if you're in a space where only so many people can relate to what you've been through.
Role models, there's more and more people coming through, but I think until you have representation from grassroots to the boardroom, you're not going to have that diversity of voice. You're not going to understand different people's positions.
Today, we're discussing elite sport, and we have three great guests. Danielle Hogan is the Diversity and Belonging Lead for England Netball. She was a junior England netballer herself and now coaches the under-17s at Birmingham Panthers in the NSL. Yasmin Clark started as a bright young tennis star. She progressed into coaching and now works as a commentator and counsellor for the LTA. She says, if you can see it, you can believe it, and you can be it. Kadina Cox, OBE, says she didn't see anyone who looked like me when she first became a cyclist. But that didn't stop her from winning multiple gold medals in athletics and cycling across three Paralympic Games from 2016 to 2024. Kadina joins us from a slightly noisy cafe on her way back from training. Kadina is a cyclist now, but her first sport was hockey.
I mean, I guess hockey is where it started in school, but actually I was a dancer from the age of four. Mum got me into dance. I basically did every sport. I was just that sporty kid that you'd want on your team. Like, I did sports hall athletics, I did football, did netball, obviously I was dancing. And it was in secondary school I started hockey. I was always fast, but everything I did, the reason I was on the team is because I was fast. So I did a testing day when I was about 14, which is what got me into athletics. And then, cycling was, that happened a long way down the line.
We'll pick up on the cycling in a minute because it's a really interesting part of your story, how you moved across into cycling but kept your athletics up as well. But I want to ask Yasmin the same question. Was it tennis from the get-go for you? And if so, who got you into it?
So I lived just down the corner from a tennis club. So it was tennis and cricket. My granddad was involved in the cricket. So he did all the grounds work. My parents, it was kind of like the only place they used to let us walk on our own. So I have an older sister and two younger brothers. And I started playing when I was seven and my sister was nine. So she was a little bit older, a little bit stronger than me. And just when I was sort of literally picking up a racket, Venus and Serena were coming on the scene. So my dad used to love to think he was Richard Williams as well, and he used to coach us. So we just really took off from there. But that's where we started, just a grassroots club.
And Danielle, I mean, you were born into a netball dynasty, weren't you?
I don't know about dynasty, but there are pictures of me on a potty on the side of the netball court. So, I guess I can't remember a time ever that there wasn't sport and in my life at all. And I often think, and it was netball at school. I did everything like the others, as you do, and you just love it. And it was just an outlet, I guess, from some of the other things that are going on in your life at times. You know, sport just always gave you that freedom, that place to be able to express yourself. But my dad has always been basketball, and I always say, if they'd have stayed together, if they were ever together, although I'm only 5'8", basketball might have been where I'd gone. But yeah, followed my mum into netball.
And what did it give you? What did netball mean to you? What would life have been without it?
You know, I often ask that question, and I think the same, as much as I moan sometimes now about being a taxi for my children. Like, I can't imagine like a Saturday and a Sunday without us, and in the week running around. So just the friendship and the camaraderie and meeting people outside of school, I always felt quite cool that I had school friends, but I also had like all these friends from netball and sport that actually a lot of them are still there now. I think that's a huge part of it.
And at what point did you clock that not everybody in netball looked like you? Because at times there have been very few black players, particularly in the national team. But it hasn't always been like that in netball, has it?
No, it hasn't. Especially, I think, in the middle sections and the grassroots further down. I mean, nationally and international level, look, netball's played in the Caribbean and it's played in Africa. So when I was growing up, and my aunties played, when I was growing up, I did actually see some black women around, a few. And I knew there were more that I, in my world, than when I looked at other sports, where, you know, sports that I love to watch, I never saw black women. But in netball, we have, I think, that Caribbean influence, that black women have played our sport at that level. The middle tier is where it's slightly different. When we won the gold medal at the Commonwealth Games a few years ago, 12 of the girls that stood on that podium, 6 of them were white and 6 of them weren't. And I remember at the time thinking, we need to talk about this. Like, this is amazing. No other amateur at that time sport, or even semi-pro sport, I don't think national sides had that level of diversity. Obviously, representation isn't where it's all at, but it's a start. And I was pretty proud of the sport at that moment.
Kadina, when you were progressing through athletics, you talked about moving from hockey into athletics, realising you were really fast. Can I ask you something? Was there a little bit of typecasting going on there? When your hockey coach said to you, you should try athletics, was that typecasting? Was it just a genuine nod to your ability?
No, I've actually never thought of it like that. Possibly, yeah. Like, my school was quite good at kind of championing the diverse athletes we had in school. So I went to school with Michael Richards, who's obviously a footballer. I was another guy, Sebastian Hines, who played for Middlesbrough for a little while. So there was quite a few like decent footballers and me that were from a black background. So they did kind of champion us, and it never felt that way. I also looked at the hockey team and I stuck out like a sore thumb, to be honest.
Is that something that happens to too many black girls in sport, that they feel that they're too much in a minority and that drives them out?
I just felt so much more comfortable being with the athletic squad. You can just have that kind of camaraderie, you know, those conversations, like you can joke about little things, you know, like, oh, my grandma does this, you know, the making grandma. Going to play hockey in a place called Adel, which is kind of like a real like middle class area within like Leeds, which I would never go to for any other reason. And like the girls kind of, they all could like afford getting a new hockey stick every other week. Whereas, you know, like I was like, oh, are you able to give me some money for my hockey stick? And it's like, oh, you're not getting that this time because, you know, your sister needs to get this. And felt so detached from what all the other girls were. And like, it was more comfortable being in athletics.
But that's so interesting. Kadina, hold that thought, because I want to pick up on this idea of a safe space and what a safe space looks like for black girls, whether that's in sport or other areas of life. And I know Danielle can bring in some of the research on that. I mean, when I think about sport, I'm going to be honest with you, Yasmin, I can't think of a sport that screams white more than tennis in all sorts of ways, including the kit. Did it ever feel to you as though you were the only black girl in tennis?
Yeah. You know, when I was playing, I don't think there was another black girl. I remember sort of every national team, every junior national championships, you know, there were 64 kids in the draw. I was maybe one of two black kids in the draw. And I think it was uncomfortable. Me and my brother always used to joke that when we went to the national tennis centres, the only people that were black were the cook and the cleaner. It has changed. I think over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, there's so many more people coming through that are black. You know, you've got Heather Watson, she's a Wimbledon mixed doubles champion. But I think Heather grew up in the States, and I think the States was slightly different than here. It had a lot more representation.
So you don't feel or recognise how uncomfortable you may have felt until you're in positions where it is more comfortable, until you can be in an environment where other people look like you and behave like you and talk and chat and have the same kind of or similar kind of cultural references, or then you like, yeah, wow, this feels like home, you know, because we live in a white world, right? So we're used to being a minority, and then as soon as you get you start to feel like your only place is home, that's that real safe, relaxed environment. And then when you are in a sport or in an environment where there's more people that look like you, you just realize the difference in your ability to really be your true self. And that obviously, with when you're talking about performance, is such a big part of it. And there's a quote that came out of the research that says, I feel like us as Black women, our safe space is other Black women. So when you're surrounded with people that look like you, have the same shared experiences, you're more likely to enjoy something than if you're in a space where only so many people can relate to what you've been through.
I agree. I think it's, I totally agree. And actually, but I think there's so few. I think I look at tennis, and as a sport, there isn't that many people at an elite level that have that shared experience. I think it's becoming better at sort of a grassroots level. I think there's more people with that shared experience, but as you go through sort of the pathway towards sort of those sort of senior leadership roles or the elite level, it becomes fewer and fewer.
Kadina, let's explain to our listeners. You were an elite athlete. You were a young woman. You suffered a stroke, and then you were diagnosed with MS, and you wanted your place in sport still, undoubtedly. Just explain to us a little bit about how cycling came along, but also what you clocked about cycling, which wasn't like athletics, was it?
For me, so I had the stroke and the MS, which impaired my right side. And so running was really hard for me. I wanted to get back into an environment where, you know, I was surrounded by other elite athletes, so I could push myself on, because I think as athletes, we're so goal-driven naturally that was the way I thought I was going to get through my diagnosis. So I was like, okay, I want to get back to sport. Like, I love the environment. Like, it's so hard to walk away from that. So I went into our college gym at my university. And it was actually because there was a watt bike in the gym that I started using the watt bike. And someone was like, oh, your powers are, like, decent. Like, you should contact British Cycling. So I did that. And I was fast-tracked onto their program, which was great, because I never would have gotten cycling any other way. Because, I mean, you look at cyclists on the road, like, you don't look like me, and you're like, I'm not going to go and jump on, you know, a bike with skinny wheels and all that. Like, it was so out. It was never something I would have, like, imagined. I stepped into this world of cycling, and I was still on the athletics program. And just going from one program to the other was so bizarre. Because, like, you know, I'd been on, like, one team, and, you know, like, there's other people. Like, I can knock on, like, my roommate's door and be like, oh, I need some products for my hair. Like, we can just be joking about stuff. Like, we can share foods and stuff. And then, you know, I go away with cycling, and I literally felt so isolated. Like, I was getting comments about my hair, like, you know, oh, just put your hair off so we can get it into the helmet, you know, why is your hair like that? I felt like in the cycling world, you have to code switch, and I have to be something that I'm not. And I felt like I was always trying to, like, play up to a part to try to fit in. Otherwise, I was really, really isolated. Whereas, you know, I'd go back to athletics and, like, even though it's not perfect, and don't get me wrong, especially in the Paralympic world, there's definitely less diversity. There was slightly more diversity in a way that I could feel comfortable. And I was quite lucky in the fact that Paula Dunn was my head coach. So I could always go to Auntie Paula, like, if I needed it. So it's just two totally different worlds.
You've brought up a question that came up so much in our research, Kadina. And I'm going to just say one word to Danielle. Hair.
Well, let's not get it twisted to start. Listen, I recognise my own privilege. I'm mixed race, right? I've got hair that I can run in a shower, run out a shower, wash my hair. And I mean, I should say, and just run with it how it is. Loads of women don't do that and feel more bothered about the hair than I do. I guess I've always thought as a sportswoman, and I can't stereotype now because loads of them would kill me, but I don't really care. about my hair. I just go wherever I need to go. And obviously, you know, especially day to day, I do try and fix up a bit when I go out, I will say. But yeah, so I have it easier. I've got two black daughters, right? And I understand, and growing up with all my friends and family who are black, dealing with hair is not easy, and it takes time, and it costs money. And it's not a question of just jumping in and out the shower or in and out of pool for rehab. And definitely have experienced times where that isn't recognized at all. And international athletes can go away on camp and we're all going to jump in the pool for rehab after a session. And the black girls are like, there's this like awkward moment of like, I don't really want to do that. Like, I can't just do that. And we can laugh about it and joke about it because it feels like it's just hair. We're proud, you know, black women are proud of their hair. And to feel like you're in a moment where you've got to explain yourself or explain why you don't want to do it, and nobody in the room, even the girls you play with and your coaches, would even recognize that it's a bit of a thing or a big thing. And I think as generations, and Yasmin mentioned it earlier, as times are changing, and I think girls feel more empowered. I know that my daughters do, but again, playing basketball when all your teammates are black, you're all dealing with the same thing, as Kadina said, you know, borrowing hair products, coming down for breakfast with your bonnet on. Like, no one's really questioning that. When I was young, nobody would have done that in a million years. We'd have all just gone about our way quietly, feeling uncomfortable or not being able to bring your true self. So those kind of things are issues that, if you're not experienced our world and understand our culture, that you just would never see it unless it's talked to and brought to your attention. And
Yasmin, what about you? Was your hair ever something that you felt you needed to talk to your coaches or your team about? Was it something you felt judged for?
Tennis was very much a predominantly white sport, and I had really curly hair, and also wasn't really sure how to look after it at that point. I think like products and things have gone, you know, they've come a long, long way now from where they were 15, 20 years ago. I know now you don't brush dry curls, but that took a long while for me to realise that. You know, my hair was always frizzy and unkept. And I think I got pulled up on that a couple of times, especially when I was travelling away as a young person. And I think it was like, you know, you need to make sure your hair's smart. And so actually, but up until probably last year, I relaxed my hair. You know, I'm mixed race as well, but my hair was quite thick and I relaxed my hair for a really long time. And I think what actually changed for me was having my daughter go, but mummy, why is your hair straight and mine's curly? And I was like, oh, actually, this is something that I really need to get to grips with. You know, I want you to be yourself. Then actually, I've got to be myself as well. So I think as soon as you said it, I laughed because I thought it is just hair. But actually, it's something that is a really, really personal choice. And I think it's sometimes not acknowledged.
Is that what it amounts to? Kadina, come back in on this one, if you will. When we talk about hair and black girls, the last thing we want to do in our research was trivialise this, but it did come up, and as did other aspects of teenage girls' feelings about their bodies and the tendency for the media and sometimes their aunties to masculinise them, to say, you know, be careful about the swimming or your arms will get big.
I mean, I was the same as Jasmine. I relaxed my hair as I was going through like my teen years. So in the last few years, you know, when it's become like cool to have natural hair, that I've gone to like embracing my natural hair. But I think that's it, like embracing our natural self is such a big thing. And I remember literally I must have been like 17 and I was, shouldn't have been on a night out, but I wasn't a night out. And I just remember some guy being like, oh, you look like a man, like why are you so hench? And like in that moment, like you spend so long trying to make your body like as strong as possible. Like, I want to be strong. Like, I want to be able to perform. But you get so many comments on the way you look. I've been compared to like Serena Williams, but like not in a positive way, in a way of like, you're so muscly, like, you know, you're so big. Because I'm right now, like as a sprinter, I am quite big for a sprinter, but I'm powerful and I'm effective. Man. So I'm like, why am I getting penalized for looking a certain way? And I think that's the same thing for a lot of females. Like when you're going through that transition, like you're kind of mid to late teens, where you're finding yourself, you're thinking about, you know, boys, you're thinking about, you know, who you are. Like, you're constantly being judged for the way your body looks. That's going to very easily be like, well, sports is thing that's making me look different to all my other friends.
My daughters are both very tall, and I was just about to say then, naturally, I hope they keep growing. But I know that they've had questions around that. My 10-year-old's probably nearly 5'7". and my 14-year-old's maybe 5'9". Now she might stop. We feel like they're going to stop soon, and I'm gutted that they might stop soon because I'm like, girls, keep going, keep going. But their social world, no, they would accept that, because everywhere they go, the first thing people say is, "Wow, you're so tall," or they question their bodies. And also the fact that we know from research that Black and Asian girls experience puberty earlier than white girls. So you're going through puberty in general at a very young age, and perhaps on average, I think about 2.5 years younger than average white children. So we've got Black girls in primary school, year fours and fives and sixes, that are starting their periods, and therefore other parts of their bodies are also developing. So that whole, you know, adultification and the way that people see you in the world is older than your years.
Are there any sports, do you think, that are closer to getting that right, to understanding the Black girls' experience? What do you think, Yasmin?
I'm just going to go just previously back to what you were saying about the size, and actually it's really interesting that you were compared to Serena. I think Serena's obviously spoken a lot about this, about the fact in the media she's always been sort of masculinized or, you know, aggressive, powerful. But it's the fact that it's seen as a negative for me. It's not the words necessarily, because I think if we've seen other athletes described in exactly the same way, but it's a completely different tone. So I think it's about how it's said. I think for me, it's about the way that it's put across, not necessarily the words, because I think actually being powerful is a great thing. In terms of sports that are getting it right, I'm not entirely sure. I think there are a few that are investing more energy and time and actually trying to understand. I know tennis is spending a lot of time now actually trying to understand and to break down those barriers, to give people opportunities to share their experience, to feel that they belong. And I'm not so sure what's happening in the other sports, but I know tennis is doing that pretty well.
Yeah. One of the things that you were saying just a moment ago, Danielle, was about this idea, and so important, not just among Black girls, but among all girls that we support at Women in Sport, is this idea that, you know, they're not a homogenous group. We've got to understand them in their differences as well. But something that seems to be more likely for Black teenagers in sport, and this comes from some stats from the Institute for Race Relations, who reported recently that nearly half of all people living in families where the household head was Black were in poverty, versus 1 in 5 where the household head was white. And I'm just wondering to what extent that shapes an experience for a Black girl, young girl in sport as well. A, the opportunity to play, but also the aspiration for a family who say, "No, I want you to study. That's the way out of poverty."
We saw it come out of the research quite a lot, that a lot of the barriers and those, the beautiful love letters and the breakup letters that a lot of the girls wrote to sport was around parents wanting their daughters to focus on academics and didn't see that there was a career in sport. And that comes from what, generations of trauma, right? Like, you had to get your head down, you moved to this country, our grandparents, their parents, and your only way was to work and work and work and work. And in our sport, in netball, it's not paid very well at all, and we're really trying to obviously push the boat. So the girls do have to do something else, and we have so many of our elite athletes that are high academic achievers alongside playing international sport and being full-time athletes, and we don't talk to that enough.
My dad was very much you know, if you came home from a test with 95%, he was like, "Well, where's the other 5? So my dad was always really honest for education and for our tennis. So he wanted us to be really well-rounded. His parents came from Jamaica and they were very much the same with him. He went English schools. He was an unbelievable sprinter. He played basketball for England, but they were very much, you need to have a job, you need to have a profession. Sport is just kind of a recreation. It's just something that you're good at, but you need to have something to be able to back that up. And I think that's why he sort of moved heaven and earth for me. When I wanted to try and play tennis, he was like, "Right, I'm going to try and give you all the opportunities that maybe that I didn't have." Mm-hmm. And I guess that's, again, what we're doing now for our children, is trying to just move those barriers on so that actually they have opportunities that we didn't have.
I grew up in a household, there's 7 kids in my household. So we had to learn to cook and clean before I could go out and do any sport. You know, I had to cook and clean. My grades had to be right. Like, I wasn't allowed to go to any extracurricular activities until, like, you know, I was making sure I was doing my work well. It is so important, but I think, like, you know, when you do come to looking at, like, poverty within Black households, for me, cycling was never on the card, partly because I couldn't afford to cycle. Like, even if I'd, like, seen it and be like, oh, yeah, I want to go do that cycling thing, like, I couldn't afford to do that. Like, my bike that I raced at the Games with everything on it was probably well over 30 grand, like, worth of just bike. And that's not even thinking about the coaching and the training time and the physio and the shoes. Like, I think my shoes were like 4 grand. All these little things add up. So I just couldn't afford, like, with my mum having to look after like 6 other kids, like, just we couldn't afford that. And like, there were so many times where I wanted things and mum wanted to give it to me, but like, she had to think about the other kids. My auntie, when she would always be like, oh, okay, like, yeah, you can have this. And like, she would, you know, help me to push forward with my sporting career. And I think maybe because of the generation my mum is that came over. So maybe if she was born here, like, it would have been a little bit easier. But with my mum obviously being, or with me being first generation, I think my mum just wasn't quite in the position that maybe I will be in for my children. So yeah, it was tricky. But I also think, like, that meant that education was drilled into me. So I have 2 degrees. I'm currently back at university, even though I'm like doing like my sport right now. That education side of things was always drilled into me. Mum was like, you know, what happens if one day you get injured? You never know what's going to happen. Like, you've got to have something to fall back on. So I've always had that, which has been a blessing. And then my grandma constantly turned on, I came over from Jamaica. Grandma, yeah. Okay, grandma.
Yeah. Oh, I love that though, Kadina, like, hearing that. Like, you wouldn't change it though, would you? The fact that you can say, I've got 2 degrees, and it's empowering. And yeah, again, it's also barriers, because when I was young, I played an international game. Like I said, I was 16, 17, and my mum, and even then when I think back, who was all into sport, played netball herself all her years. I only had one sibling. I was playing in Ireland and she couldn't afford to come watch me. And that's just Ireland with one sibling, let alone traveling further afield and having like 5 siblings, say. Every other parent was there. To know that my mum was a netballer, how much she would have loved to have seen me, like, sing the national anthem and be there in my kit, and she couldn't be there. And it was all down to finances, you know, dropping you off and taking you places constantly. Parents now that I see, I coach, they are in the performance space, and it's predominantly white, probably 85% white in the performance space. And all the kids' parents are just there at everything, anywhere they need to go, however far they need to take them. And obviously parents will drop stuff, Black parents to do the same, but majority are white parents that can afford it. And the Black girls aren't even getting through the door because they're not gifted with the same privilege and opportunity that others get given.
Thank you all so much for sharing so much about your experiences. At Women in Sport, we've completed the research. We're looking at what next. So I have a final question for each of you. If I could come to you first, Yasmin, I want you to really throw down the gauntlet, be really bold here. What does sport, either your sport or sport in general, or all the people who work around the edges of it, it might be the media, it might be a question of representation, or it might be your governing body, what do they need to do to make Black girls feel like they belong?
I think representation's the big one for me. I think role models, there's more and more people coming through, but I think until you have representation from grassroots to the boardroom, you're not going to have that diversity of voice. You're not going to understand different people's positions. I think one of the things that is happening at the minute is there is a big drive on inclusion. And for me, it's not just about opening the door, it's making sure that people feel welcome, that actually their experiences are going to be valued once they come in. So I think for me, it's about having that representation at every single level of your sport.
Kadina, what would you do to throw down the gauntlet in sport to say, keep these Black girls, break down the barriers, they deserve to be here?
I agree with everything Yasmin said. So I set up an academy called the KC Academy to get more people from a Black background in cycling, just to try to take out, you know, the cost, try to take out, you know, being able to access facilities, being able to, you know, access and nutritionist and all these other like things, our white counterparts that they can access. But I think it's so important for us, for the governing body, and I've tried to talk to British Cycling about it, to actually go out into the areas seeking to get these athletes. Because, like, let's be honest, like, so I'm trying to get people in at the top level, the elite level, so we've got more Kabinas, you know, at the top for these young kids to look at. But I can't get the grassroots kids in and get the elite level. And like, do you know what I mean? Like, so they need to be going out into these different areas and like, you know, putting on workshops and saying, you know, do you want to have a try at this? Like giving them like taster sessions on the track, giving them taster sessions like on road bikes, just giving them opportunity. Because for sports like cycling, where it is so costly, it's lack of opportunity and lack of access that we don't have. And then when we do get through the door, like it is having, you know, having the coaches in there, like, you know, giving the opportunity for a coach to come in and be able to do the course so that then they can coach the kids in the local area. Because, you know, we don't have black coaches that are coaching cycling. I think we've got maybe one test, and then having the people in there that are going to be able to support us through and understand what we're going through on a daily.
Understand what we're going through on a daily. Danielle, is that what sport needs to do?
100%. I would add to that. I think you've got three different but really well connected answers there, with Jasmine talking about the representation and Kadena like going out and recruiting and engaging in local communities. The next point that just adds to that is 100% about the people that we have got in sport now. If I had a message to sport, it would be, look, sport is delivered, coached, officiated, majority white. And those people need to recognise that you need to do some learning and some education and figure out, understand how you need to adapt to the people that you've got around you. Sport, people who play sport, the athletes are going to keep growing and growing in the diversity. The best performing teams in the world are diverse, whether that's in the boardroom or on the track or pitch or court. So let's not get it twisted and recognize that the representation will hopefully grow and change, but it will take some time. For me, if you want to step into the world of performance sport now, or you're already in that, then understand that your style, your behavior, your education all needs to be adaptable to enable you to connect with those people that you are working with. The other day there was something happened where there was an umpire questioning an athlete who was wearing leggings, and the athlete is Muslim and is absolutely fine to wear leggings. Our uniform is an issue with a lot of women and girls that we wear dresses, but recognizing and understanding, if you're in a space where you don't interact with people from different backgrounds, I as a black woman in this space don't know it all. I'm a coach. I need to understand the difference of the girls that I'm coaching and where they're coming from and their backgrounds. I don't know it all, and I feel as a coach in a performance space that that is my responsibility to do that. And so that would be my first message to sport, that people get with the program.
Danielle, if that little black girl had heard what was said about her wearing leggings and the official at that match, how would she have felt about sport? Is that a possible exit moment?
100%. Of course it is, because it's already a struggle, and you know, it's 2025. So to hear in an environment that you feel safe in, or starting to feel safe in an environment that I know the people around her are trying to create a safe space, to hear those things, it's just a kick in the teeth that you just don't need. And you're already fighting. She's already going to be fasting next week. The organisation and the people around her need to support that and recognise, while she's fasting, how do we adjust her training? So then to hear something as simple as a kick thing being an issue is just another barrier. Very easy for a 16-year-old at that point to say, you know what, this isn't sport for me, I'm out.
That's it for this episode of the Women in Sport podcast. My thanks to my guests, Danielle Hogan, Kadena Cox and Yasmin Clark. If you enjoyed this conversation, please listen to our episode on Black girls' experiences of grassroots sport. And please remember to like, subscribe and rate wherever you get your podcasts. If you love what our charity stands for, please do consider making a donation at womeninsport.org. Any donations received before the 31st of March 2025 will be doubled by a generous donor to mark our 40th anniversary. You can find us on all the usual socials, so follow us and tell us what sports you love and what you're doing to create change. Many thanks to Whistledown Productions in London, where this podcast was recorded. And thanks to you for listening. My name is Julia George. And remember, everyone should be included in the joy, fulfillment, and lifelong benefits of sport. See you next time.